In rural Vermont, gun ownership is a fact of life. Most people who encounter firearms there don't get hurt. But between 2011 and 2016, 420 people died from gunshot wounds in Vermont. Taylor Dobbs and his team at Vermont Public Radio looked at each and every one of those cases and analyzed the data to try to make some sense of those numbers.
We were looking over 6 years of data from the beginning of 2011 through the end of 2016, and we found during that time that there were 420 deaths involving firearms in Vermont. Of those 420, 373 people died by suicide, and that makes up about 89% of the deaths overall, which is above the national average. Overall, that is 1.26% of all deaths in Vermont, to put that into perspective a little bit. So it's a very small portion of the overall deaths in Vermont, but we did want to look into it and see exactly who's being affected and in which ways.
Well, having 89% of all gun deaths in Vermont being suicides is well above the national average. I mean it's way out in front.
That's right. And, you know, as we've heard from people who study gun deaths nationally, rural gun deaths tend to skew more towards suicide. In big cities, there's a higher rate of violent crime generally, and that includes gun crime. And since Vermont really doesn't have any big cities, Burlington is the biggest city with less than 50,000 people, then we end up with a data set that is skewed towards rural. And in that sense, 89% really isn't that far off of the national average if you're just looking at rural areas. And at the same time, there's a sense where people worry about police response times being too long. A gun becomes a relatively practical thing for people to keep around. We heard from one member of our audience who described guns in rural Vermont much like any other tool that is also sometimes dangerous, like an axe or a tractor. And that view of guns is fairly common in Vermont, but you also have both sides of the classic gun debate where there's people who are very fiercely protective of all gun rights and don't want any controls. And then on the other side, people who think guns really don't have a role in civilian life.
But Taylor, these suicides are affecting whom? What do you know?
In Vermont, about 7.25% of our population is veterans. Among the data set that we were working with, 30% of the people who died by gunshot wound in Vermont over that six-year period were active duty or veterans. So that's way out of proportion with the general population. And many of the forces that are involved with coming back into society after a deployment, even if there's no mental health issues involved, it can be very difficult to go from an environment where you're around the same group of people every day, relying on each other very closely, and you have this sense of closeness, to a society, especially in rural Vermont, where you can go through a whole day without really seeing many people at all, and definitely without relying on anyone as closely. So you have a lot of these dynamics in play for veterans that don't exist in the general population. And then, of course, these are all people who have been trained to use weapons, and many veterans are firearms hobbyists and are likely to own guns themselves as well.
So guns are a part of life in Vermont, and I wouldn't expect that that would change anytime soon, and maybe it shouldn't. At the same time, it's pretty clear from the data, Taylor Dobbs, that you examined that there is a problem in Vermont. And I wonder if experts or advocates looking at this data are trying to talk about new ways of thinking about guns in homes with so many veterans in Vermont, knowing that guns aren't going to go away, but knowing that maybe some kind of different approach is needed here.
There are already things going on in Vermont to that effect that have really nothing to do with new legislation or policy, because those become non-starters very quickly in the state house here. But there's a state-designated mental health agency called Howard Center here in Chittenden County, which is the most populous county in Vermont. And they actually send their caseworkers around with gun locks that they give away for free to families that, you know, they might have a gun that they're not storing behind lock and key. So they'll give them a gun lock that makes the gun impossible to fire without unlocking it. And the experts we talked to really said that that type of step can make a really big difference in a home with a gun.
Close to 9 in 10 gun deaths in the state of Vermont between 2011 and 2016, suicides. That's according to data examined by Taylor Dobbs and the team at Vermont Public Radio. Taylor Dobbs, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be on. Thank you.
Well, we just heard about Vermont's gun culture and how it affects life in that state. But away from rural Vermont, in small cities across America, gun violence is a daily reality. While violence is mostly down in big cities, in some small cities, it's worse than ever. Take Wilmington, Delaware, population 72,000, where young people between 12 and 17 years old are more likely to be shot than in any other city in the United States. USA Today and the Associated Press looked at this problem. They issued a report earlier this month, and they found that during a 3.5-year period, roughly 3 out of every 1,000 adolescents were injured or killed from gun violence in Wilmington, and that's a rate nearly twice that of Chicago. Yasser Payne is an associate professor at the University of Delaware who has studied Wilmington's gun problem for years, and he joins me now. Professor Payne, thank you for being here.
Glad to be with you.
What's going on in Wilmington to cause this?
I would argue that with respect to younger people, in this case, 12 to 17 year olds, you're really looking at violence that's sparked by there's a retaliatory dynamic. I would say it's not mostly over drug sales or drug turfs as a function of economic opportunity and having to protect it. And therefore, we're engaging in war. You do have some of that. Right. But the drug market is much different today than it was in the 1990s or the early 2000s. What you have are young folk. Right. Definitely who are looking for to identify with something. Right. They're looking for bonding. They're also looking for protection. And gangs and or street crews can provide that, particularly to vulnerable adolescents. And I think when you have, in addition to a predictor with regard to poverty or economic poverty, it exacerbates, right, this social dynamic on the ground even more.
Is there something about the geography, the makeup of a small city like Wilmington that can exacerbate all of these problems?
Yes, I do think city size definitely plays a real role or a factor. Keep in mind, right, I'm a street ethnographer, so I'm on the ground. We do these large survey samples, but we also get inside notions of ethnography or inside the lived experiences of these people. And I'm coming from my research background previous to Wilmington is New York City, North New Jersey, right? So there's a different kind of population there. However, in a small or medium-sized city, right, violence and or other phenomena, but definitely violence reverberates across the city in ways that you don't see or experience in big cities, right? So it is very common to experience violent crime, right? And the victim is still close to the perpetrator's family and or friends, right? And given that you may have to see the victim see the perpetrator or the perpetrator see the victim or victim's loved ones in store corners or at the local community center or at school, right? The fact that you are constantly bumping into one another, I also think predicts or concentrates or exacerbates the kind of violence that we're seeing in Wilmington.
Your work has brought you to the streets and in the homes of people in Wilmington. You've talked to hundreds of residents there. How does this violence affect their lives?
Man, I've done street ethnographic work in a number of cities now. And I've not been to one city, right, where I have met more people one day and then on the next day they are harmed, if not killed, right, and or their loved ones harmed or killed. So when you have that kind of experience, right, particularly as a university professor, right, I'm not a local resident living in Wilmington, Delaware. I live outside the city, but my work primarily is in Wilmington, Delaware around violence. But when you have that kind of experience, particularly as a university professor, I now can appreciate their experience a little bit more deeply, if you will. Right. So for me, I've had, you know, a number of folks, because keep in mind, I do street participatory action research. I take folk who are involved in the criminal justice system and or the streets of Wilmington. And I say, hey, let's get on my research team. Let's do some research around this topic, particularly in the way that you want to. And also let's do some action and activism. Right. And the first project, the People's Report, we had 15 folk from the streets of Wilmington. Right. 12 men, 3 women. And keep in mind, many of the folk that I'm working with are experiencing the violence. I had one young man who was actually shot and paralyzed while working on the project. Jonathan Wilson, he's now a doctoral student at Wilmington University. I had another gentleman who was also shot. I had another gentleman whose son was also shot. So I'm experiencing this also as a university professor at a personal level, not to mention what local residents are experiencing on a day-to-day basis.
And Yasser Payne, when you talk to those people talk to you who you're dealing with every day, what are they saying to you about this violence, this close-in violence to their lives, and how it affects their ability to get by day to day?
I would say largely, keep in mind, Wilmington is a very loving city and or small town, right? We found high levels of psychological and social well-being, right? We found, even though our sample of 500 folk, right, of mostly street-identified black men and women in the East Side and Southbridge neighborhoods of Wilmington, even though they are, to some extent, you know, involved in crime and or had some experiences around violence, keep this in mind, they had high levels of esteem, personal levels of esteem, family esteem, as well as social cohesion, if you will. And it may sound ironic or counterintuitive, but for us, it is very intuitive, right? Low-income black and brown people are loving people, and these are loving neighborhoods. If anything, they would argue that structural violence, inequality, a lack of economic opportunity, joblessness is far more predictive of the kind of violence and or crime that we're seeing in cities like Wilmington than anything else. Keep in mind, out of our survey sample, we found nearly 70% of the men between the ages of 18 to 35 in the two neighborhoods that we were working out of were unemployed. About 63% of the women were unemployed. And we did quota sampling, which means to some extent we can generalize our data to these neighborhoods, right? Just imagine 70% of the men, young men, walking around without jobs. Right. In the neighborhood that we were operating out of, Southbridge, one of the two neighborhoods at the time of the study, we were able to get our hands on some educational data, meaning city level data, and found that 100% of the black boys in Southbridge were dropping out of high school years on end. Right. And we know that dropout rates are predictive of unemployment. It's predictive of incarceration rates. It's predictive of all sorts of crimes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When there is a kind of blind acknowledgement of the kind of inequality, structural violence, you're talking about third world living conditions or third world neighborhoods, right, that folk are immersed in, mind you, sitting side by side to some of the largest levels of wealth that the country has ever experienced. I think that's the other effect with regard to a small city, right? Because now, right, wealth literally sits side by side next to extreme economic poverty, at least in ways that it's not experienced in cities, in large cities like Chicago or New York City.
Yasser Payne, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Todd. I really appreciate it.
Yasser Payne is associate professor at the University of Delaware.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.